Hello and welcome in.
Science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. It was Nancy Reagan who called it a long, long goodbye. And today in the UK, 850,000 people suffer from Alzheimer's disease and the more general dementia. At the moment, we have no cure, and there's still not a complete consensus on the causes of Alzheimer's and related diseases. But there is hope, and a concerted effort to find out why this disease manifests, what the effects are, and work towards treatment and that elusive cure. My guest today is Selena Ray. Selena is a senior research fellow for Alzheimer's Research UK, working at UCL's Institute of Neurology, and there she works on the early signs of Alzheimer's development and uses cell cultures to investigate the causes and effects of this disease on brain cells. Her results feed into clinical work of Alzheimer's Research UK to gain a better understanding of work and work towards the treatments of this destructive disease. Welcome, Selena.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's great to have you on. Today we're going to talk a little bit about your research and how you do it and what you do. But first, I'm going to subject you and the listeners out there to a very quick mini cognitive test. So I have to stress that I am not a qualified medical practitioner, and that this test in no way constitutes a, you know, careful or considered diagnosis. If you're in doubt, go and see a real doctor. But everyone listening can do this along with us. So the first step will just be memorize these three words: tree, apple, and sandwich. Okay, that's tree, apple, and sandwich. And now the second step that you can do along at home as well is, without looking at a wall nearby, draw a clock from memory. So like an analog clock, a kind of wall clock that you normally see, and do that. And so we're going to do that in the studio, and you can do it at home. And also, while we do that, we're going to have a listen to your first song. And you've chosen Junior Walker and the All-Stars with I Am a Roadrunner. Why did you choose this?
So I grew up listening to a lot of Motown, basically. It was a big, very popular amongst my family. And I just find Motown as a genre really uplifting and really cheerful. So it's something that stuck with me throughout my life. We always stick it on at home, stick it on in the lab. And I just like the energy and the positive messages that come through the song.
Yeah, so that was Roadrunner by Junior Walker and the All-Stars. And before we headed off to have a little listen to that and wake us up in the morning, we had a little mini cognition test. And so I asked Selena here to draw a clock. And, I mean, she's done pretty well. I mean, we were just saying, actually, it's a little bit of cheating because there is a clock on the wall just behind me, which I didn't know because it's behind me and I couldn't see it. But, you know, all the numbers are in the right place. And apparently, this is actually a test that they use, you know, to check on the kind of early stages of dementia. Can people remember where the numbers are? Sometimes it's quite hard to, you know, think ahead and place them in the right place, but she's managed to do it. She's chosen 4 o'clock, which, any particular, you know?
No, I wonder, there's probably some significance that we can gain from that. I'm not sure what it is.
No, I'm not sure what it is. So, I mean, so this is like a test that picks up the early symptoms of dementia and Alzheimer's. But, I mean, what are the symptoms? What is this kind of test looking for, and how does it affect people?
So Alzheimer's and dementia more generally can affect all of our kind of cognitive higher function. So things like memory is the typical symptom. Although I would actually say, you know, I would say that I have a bad memory. I think it's all a kind of factor of change. People notice their memory getting much, much worse. We all get forgetful from time to time. But aside from memory, there are other things like our ability to plan, our ability ability to manage situations, empathy. So some people with rarer forms of dementia, such as frontotemporal dementia, can become aggressive.
So this this means that it modifies like a particular area of the brain.
Exactly. So frontotemporal dementia modifies the frontal and temporal lobes.
That kind of makes sense.
Where it got its name from.
Logical name.
Exactly. But then, you know, people, it's actually a huge issue in the diagnosis of dementia, because if people become depressed or apathetic or uncharacteristically aggressive, that might not typically be thought of as dementia. So of course it makes diagnosis much, much more difficult.
Yeah, so I guess people have an idea of dementia and I just think, oh, it's just forgetting things, right? But it's kind of a bit more subtle than that, and it affects larger areas of the brain. What kind of people are susceptible to this? Like when do the effects of Alzheimer's appear?
So we typically talk about Alzheimer's as affecting predominantly people aged 65 and over, but that isn't always the case. There are people who develop early onset dementia. So actually the youngest person who I've been aware of through my work was actually 35 with frontotemporal dementia. Now, you never think it can affect people so young.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the big misconceptions, that it's just, you know, I remember when I first started in research, people saying to me, why do you want to work on Alzheimer's disease? It's just old people getting forgetful.
Yeah.
And it's really not. So I think the more we can do to kind of break down that conception, the better.
And I mean, what's the, If you do get diagnosed with Alzheimer's, what's the prognosis? Is it ultimately fatal, or are people generally, is it something that people can live with for a long time?
So you can, I think it's really important to say that you can live well with Alzheimer's and you can live well with dementia. And, you know, we try and be careful to say that people are living with dementia rather than suffering from dementia, because you, as a society, we can help people really live full and fulfilled lives with dementia. However, Alzheimer's is a progressive disease. We don't have any treatments which will slow or stop its progression. So ultimately, people will die with Alzheimer's disease, and it's generally from, as the brain becomes more and more affected, it's generally the complications of the disease. So people can't move around as much, they're more susceptible to infections, breathing difficulties and things like that.
So it does, it itself is not ultimately fatal, but it is a contributing factor
to
lots of things. People don't move around so much, that sort of thing. So, I mean, what kind of understanding do we have at the moment of the pathology of the disease, or like how is it actually manifesting? Because, you know, you can see the obvious symptoms are, you know, as we discussed earlier, but how what's happening inside the brain?
So Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia are caused by the progressive loss of brain cells. So the cells are called neurons, and they progressively die over time. Now, there are a range of things that can cause that to happen, and we don't fully understand why this is happening. But what we do see when we look at the brains of people with dementia is that there is an abnormal accumulation of specific proteins in specific areas. So, for example, I work on a protein called tau, which builds up in the brain of people with Alzheimer's, and it builds up in the areas of the brain that affect memory, that affect decision making, that affect emotion. So that has a direct effect on the symptoms that that person will develop.
But I mean, don't cells die in the body all the time? So what's the problem with neurons dying?
So the brain is quite special in that those cells can't regenerate. So, for example, if we think about our skin, we know we renew our skin every 28, not our whole skin every 20, but skin cells are constantly shedding and regenerating. The same with our liver. We all damage our liver from time to time with a few too many drinks.
So, you know, sometimes, you know, more heavily than others.
Exactly. But, yeah. But the liver is able, to a certain extent, to replace damaged cells. The brain can't do that. Once those cells are gone, they're gone, which is why we get this progressive deterioration.
Right. So brain cells are kind of, they're different. Are they different in other ways? Do they have, you know, like the same requirements as other cells in the body, or?
So they are exceptionally long-lived. As I just said, we can't renew brain cells. So they, once they're born, they live, many of them stay with us for our entire adult lives. And they are exceptionally energy demanding. So all of our cells require energy that we derive from our food, for example, to perform their function. But more than any other cell type, the neurons of the brain are really have very high energy requirements. And that's because they are essentially controlling everything that makes us human.
All right. So this whole like eat breakfast to give yourself energy is really, otherwise you just can't think properly.
Exactly.
So if you haven't had breakfast yet, please do indulge. We're gonna go on to your second song, and so for that you've chosen Otis Redding and Try a Little Tenderness. Why this one?
So again, I had an uncle who sadly passed away now, but who I was very close to, and Otis Redding was his absolute favourite artist. So he's someone I've listened to from being a child. He's someone who I absolutely adore, and I don't think, how can anyone not like this song? It's so full of feeling and emotion, and I figured it was a good Saturday morning chill track to have on.
So that was Otis Redding with Try a Little Tenderness. And we're here in the studio with Selena Ray, who does research on Alzheimer's. And earlier we were talking about what this disease is, how it manifests, and how it affects people generally later in life, but it can be a bit earlier, as we've learned. So you're doing research into this disease. What kind of stuff are you looking into? You work in the lab, is that right?
That's right, yeah. So we are interested in trying to understand the very earliest changes that happen in brain cells associated with dementia. And the reason for that is because we believe that if we understand the very first things to go wrong, that is where a treatment will be most effective, if we can stop things from changing right at the beginning.
So rather than kind of treating the symptoms of the disease at later stages, you're actually affecting what the original changes are in the brain.
Absolutely. That's what we are aiming for. So the way that we do that is we actually grow cells that we take from patients themselves. So we are using a relatively new technique one of the challenges in the field is that it's quite difficult to grow brain cells in the lab,
right? Yeah.
And it's not easy to take a sample of someone's brain during life. People generally are not that keen for that,
I kind of need my brain. I don't really want you to take bits of it. That doesn't sound right.
Exactly. So we have to be creative, and we have to think, how else can we get these cells? And a technique which actually ended up winning the Nobel Prize in 2012 showed that it's possible to change cells from being one type of cell into another type of cell, which sounds pretty mind-blowing, but what it actually means is that we can take a sample of someone's skin, grow their skin cells in the lab, pretty straightforward. Then we can treat these cells with a series of factors which allow us to take them from being a skin cell into a stem cell. And because the stem cell is essentially a blank slate, it has the potential to become any cell type.
When you say stem cells, I think of like embryonic stem cells. These are the things that your body develops into. It starts as a stem cells and then goes on there. So you're saying that now that you don't actually have to take those embryonic stem cells, you can just use any cell.
Exactly. So for a long time, the dogma was that you went from a stem cell to another cell, and that was a one-way street. And actually what we've recently learned is that that's not true. We can now take a specialized cell and essentially reset its clock. We can take it back in time to the point when it was unspecialized.
So is that something that happens in the body that we've discovered, or is that kind of a different technique that people have developed?
It's a technique that people have developed, and it was largely born out of necessity, because as you say, the kind of traditional, if you like, source for stem cells was from early stage embryos. And for example, in the US under the Bush administration, research using embryonic stem cells was quite restricted.
Yeah, there's all sorts of moral questions about whether that's okay or not.
Exactly. And so there were several groups of researchers that became kind of frustrated about this and said, right, let's be creative and see how else we can get these cells. And then they developed this technique which allowed us to make these induced stem cells, so stem cells which have been created from other cell types.
Okay, so you've now got these stem cells that you've developed from, or you've regressed or ungrown, I don't know what the right word
rejuvenated,
there we go, back to stem cells. And then what do you do with them?
So because stem cells have the potential, as I say, to become any cell type given the correct signals, we give them the signal that they require to become brain cells or neurons. So what this means is we take cells from people who have a genetic form of dementia, which is rare, but we're fortunate enough to work closely with several patient groups who are really happy to participate in research. And we compare those cells to those from people who don't have any form of dementia. And we can grow those cells side by side in the lab, the brain cells, and say, okay, what is different about the cells from patients with dementia compared to our cells from people who don't have dementia?
Okay, so this is a specific type of Alzheimer's that's genetic. Does that mean that people are kind of predisposed to it?
Yep, so most Alzheimer's is not genetic in the sense of being passed from parent to child, but there are, I think, between 1% and 5% of cases are hereditary. So it means that there is a gene in that family which, if you inherit that gene, you would have pretty much 100% chance of developing the disease. So these are incredibly rare, but what we find is a number of these families, because Alzheimer's disease has had such an impact on them, they really are heavily involved in research and want to contribute as much as possible to help us find those treatments.
Yeah, so it really is a kind of life-changing disease, and it affects people a lot, and people are very willing to do chronic.
Absolutely. And if you've had several generations of your family live with dementia, then I can't even begin to imagine the impact. But it's for us, it's really humbling to see how it motivates people to really help us in our research.
So you're looking at these cells from these people who are kind enough mm-hmm. to have donated their skin, and what is it exactly you're looking at just with these, you know, neurons in a dish? I'm assuming this is just in a little, you know,
we grow them in plastic dishes in the lab, and we look at several things. So I mentioned earlier that in the brain, when someone has dementia, there will be an abnormal buildup of proteins. So I work
these on tau proteins, is that
exactly
what you're saying?
Yeah. So we look in our cells to see if we can detect changes to tau protein in our cell culture, and although it's early days, it does look like we can detect certain tau signatures, if you like, or tau barcodes, I like to think of them as, which distinguish the dementia cells from the cells from our control participants.
And so what kind of techniques are you using to differentiate these? Are you just looking at them under a microscope?
We do a lot of microscope work just generally to look at the health of the cells, so we can check if they're the same shape, the same size, so neurons have a lot of branches. They're almost a bit like a tree, so we can see if the branching complexity is the same in our dementia cells and our non-dementia cells. And then we can also use techniques to look specifically at the protein that we are interested in. So I can use techniques which specifically label the tau in the cells and see if there's the same amount of tau, if it's in the same location in the cell, if it's accumulating in a specific area. A lot of microscope work.
A lot of microscope work. And how do you, these cells, how do you keep them alive? Because, I mean, inside the brain is quite a nice environment for a cell to live, right? It's all, there's the same temperature and moisture and all this kind of stuff. So do you have to work quite hard to keep these things going?
We do. I mean, we replicate that environment as best we can. So every cell type that we grow in the lab has its own specific, what we call cell media, which is essentially liquid food. It's about £150 a bottle, and I would not dream of spending that on a bottle of wine, but somehow we'll happily spend that for our little cells. We keep them in incubators, so they're at 37 degrees, so replicating the temperature, the kind of carbon dioxide levels are maintained so that they are what keeps the cells alive. And also, because they're human cells, they can pick up infections, they can pick up bacterial infections, for example. So we're incredibly careful to work under sterile conditions so that our cells don't become infected.
I hadn't ever thought of that, that your cell cultures can get sick in the same way that you can.
Right, exactly. So baking bread and brewing beer is my absolute nightmare, because the possibility of introducing a yeast infection into our cultures
is.
Yeah, so we're very, you know, we're always gloved up. We sterilize everything with ethanol before we even go near our cells. So yeah, we look after them. They're pampered.
Have to work quite hard. Yeah, sounds like a all right life. We've got your third song now. You've chosen Tori Amos and Crucify. Any particular reason?
So I got into Tori Amos as a kind of angsty teenager when I just started secondary school. And, you know, this is from her first album, Little Earthquakes. And I love the whole album. I go back to it time and time again. And I think really for me, it was the first example where I'd really got into a female artist telling her own powerful story through songs. So I again, it's a very raw album. And I really love all the songs on there.
Every finger in the room is pointing at me. I want to spit in their faces, then I get afraid of what that could bring. I got a bowling ball in my stomach, I got a desert in my mouth. Figures that my courage would choose to sell out now. I've been looking for a savior in these dirty streets. Looking for a savior beneath these dirty sheets. I've been raising up.
So that was Tori Amos with Crucify. So we're talking about why, how these cells end up dying, and the research that you're doing, looking into them, research in petri dishes and stuff. This is due to a buildup of these tau proteins, right? And is it that the brain is more susceptible to these proteins because of the high energy requirements you were talking about earlier? Is that linked?
So I think that there are a number of things that could be playing a role here, and we've not quite untangled which is the most crucial, and it's probably a combination of all of them. But tau is a function in the brain, first of all. It's involved, so neurons are very long specialized cells, so they have these long processors and they require a transport system to move things around the cell,
right?
And so tau's role in that is almost like the sleepers holding railway tracks in place.
Okay.
So if the tau starts to build up, it can no longer perform that function. So that means that, you know, the parts of the cell which would be traveling these long distances are no longer able to get to where they are required.
Okay.
So that is bad for neuronal health, but it's also accompanied by this buildup of protein that would not normally be there. And we don't quite understand what the consequences of having this kind of lump of protein sitting within a cell are. We assume that they're not good, but we're kind of untangling what order things happen in and which kind of is really driving the disease. We also know, and this is something that's been a bit of a hot topic in recent years, that the abnormal proteins can travel from one cell to another. So a cell might try and deal with this kind of buildup of protein by expelling it, but then that can get taken up by a neighboring cell.
Right, and then that process then gets passed on to another
cell.
Exactly,
so it propagates throughout the brain and actually probably makes things worse. So there are kind of a number of different things going on that are probably all important, and we need to think about really tackling them all.
And you were saying that the things that you study or specifically are sometimes these genetic factors. That's not in like the whole picture. There are other environmental factors that can, you know, affect the onset of Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so it's there undoubtedly are kind of lifestyle and environmental factors that will modify a person's risk of developing Alzheimer's. It's incredibly difficult for us to get to the bottom of what those are, because of course, if a disease typically manifests in people who are over 65, you're looking at a whole lifetime of experience. Yeah. and risk, essentially. But there are a few things that are starting to come through. So we believe really just generally what's good for the heart is good for the head.
Right.
So, you know, healthy diet, lots of exercise.
Brisk 10-minute walk, this sort of thing.
Exactly.
Know, that we aren't doing in the UK. Come on, guys.
Exactly. And it's also, you know, I always get asked, well, should I be doing crosswords? Should I be doing Sudoku?
Yeah. What's the latest thinking?
You know, I think the evidence for that is less strong, but it certainly won't harm you if you enjoy doing that. I'm not going to say start doing 10 crosswords a day and it will prevent your Alzheimer's. That's certainly not the case. But certainly one thing that does seem to be important is social interaction and keeping kind of socially stimulated people, and that's also important in helping people live well with dementia, is that it can quite often people can become withdrawn or kind of withdraw from their social circles. So I think kind of maintaining that social activity is really, it's good for us irrespective of dementia. So
yeah, and so that's kind of like a more, you know, how to deal with it. How and in general, the more clinical work, how does what you're doing kind of feed into that? Are you still very much at the early stages of research, or is there some movement into potential treatments, or I'm loath to say cure, because it's
yeah, I would also always say treatment rather than cure. I mean, I think what I find really exciting about where I work is we really do span the whole spectrum of research from bench to bedside, to use a corny phrase, and I'm very, very much at the bench. Our hope is that the cell models we develop will eventually be suitable for drug screening, for example, to look for things that could then pass through the pathway to a clinical trial. But actually, there are clinical trials ongoing right now, and we have a specialised unit at UCL where they are really able to do first into man trials. And this is for across the whole of neurodegeneration. So not only Alzheimer's, but Parkinson's, motor neurons disease, Huntington's disease. And I would stress that we see a lot of similarities in these diseases, such as protein accumulation. Right. So I really believe that, you know, we get a breakthrough in one of those diseases and it helps us in all of them. So I really feel quite optimistic, even though the work that I'm doing is quite far away from that.
Yeah, so we had Ed Wild on a few weeks ago.
And I know Ed.
Yeah, he's doing some work in the Huntington's, and they have some really exciting work where they're actually moving to clinical stages. Like these diseases, the related kind of degenerative neurological diseases, there's a lot of work being done, and there's actually quite a lot of success.
Yeah, there really is. And, you know, there's a similar trial which is centered in the States, but UCL is the kind of UK center for that, trying to administer an experimental therapy in pre-symptomatic Alzheimer's to see if we can delay the onset of the disease. And I think, you know, it's not every trial will be successful, but we have to keep trying. And it's a really exciting time to be involved in research.
Definitely. Really exciting. So let's have your next song. You've chosen Vampire Weekend with A Punk. This is a bit of a mix-up from the last Tori Amos. Why did you choose this one?
So this album came out when I was a PhD student, and it really reminds me of a happy time, kind of just getting into research and being really excited about the work I was doing. And we had this album on in the lab constantly. So it used to come out, we'd stick it on repeat, but it's only about 25 minutes long. So I think within the first week, we'd listened to this album about 100 times, and I didn't listen to it again for 10 years. So I'm just rediscovering it now.
Brazilian frogs whisper sweet nothings. Cassini, the Saturn probe, looks its last. A new genetic component is linked to Alzheimer's. So there we go, we've got our three little bits of science news to look at. And we've got a really relevant one, actually. So let's start with that. This is a big paper, a big investigative paper that's come out that's linking these tau proteins that we were just talking about with a particular gene. Is that what this is doing?
It's a gene called ApoE, and a particular version of this gene, ApoE4, we've known for a long time is a big genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's. So it won't, when I say risk factor, it means if you carry this gene, it's not 100% guaranteed that you will get Alzheimer's, but it substantially increases your risk.
Okay, so this is kind of different from the stuff that you were doing before, where there's a very high chance with this particular...
Exactly. This is a risk modifier, but it's still... I mean, what this paper has shown us is it's really bad news to carry this gene. You don't want to carry it, ApoE4. So for a long time, we've known that this increases your risk, and it's always been thought that it affects a particular pathway called the amyloid processing pathway. So the production of an amyloid protein, which is the other protein that builds up in Alzheimer's brain. So there's amyloid and tau. What this paper is showing is that ApoE4 really affects tau buildup as well. So it's, and that's why it's such bad news, because it's actually having a negative impact on the two main pathologies in Alzheimer's disease.
Right, so it's kind of like a double whammy.
Exactly. And there are also quite a few different diseases where you have tau in isolation. So you don't have this amyloid buildup, you only have a buildup of tau. And what this paper suggests is that perhaps the APOE4 gene could make those worse too, or could increase your risk of developing those. So it's really, it's a big finding. And I think it really stresses to us the importance of understanding what this APOE4 really, gene is doing.
Right, so a big advancement, and you know, I can't believe it came out. It only came out a few days ago, or
it
last
came
week
out on Wednesday night. So that's it's kind of on my weekend reading list, is to really go through this in depth,
get through it, and work it out. I found some other one story which I just think is funny, which is that there was some research done into these Brazilian frogs, and they found out that the mating calls of the frogs can't be heard by the frogs, which strikes me as completely bizarre. So there's these two species of Brazilian rainforest frogs, and they can't hear the frogs they mate, the sounds they make. So the two frogs are, now here I'm going to go for with my pronunciation, Brachycephalus ephippium and Brachycephalus pitanga.
I'm impressed.
I've been working on that. And they're two brightly coloured, kind of poisonous, they call them earless frogs, and it means they don't have an external eardrum. But they've still got the inner ear structure, so they can hear a bit. Okay. But it turns out that the scientists who were part of an international team from Brazil and Denmark and the UK discovered that the calls they make can't be detected because of these ear structures. So they can only hear sounds in a range that's outside of the range that the frogs actually make the calls from. And what's kind of amazing is, like, there's a cost to making a call, right? You know, if you're trying to attract a member of the opposite sex, and instead you attract a predator, then you get eaten. So surely, if they can't even attract the mate, there would be some sort of pressure to prevent them from making the calls, and eventually they'd stop making them. What their research have said is they think it's just because they're so toxic. So they've already got such a good defense that there's not that kind of evolutionary pressure to stop them making the calls, and so they just end up keep doing them.
That just makes me feel quite sad that these little frogs are calling out for a mate
just into the void, and no one can hear them. They also seem to think that maybe their like mating is a bit more visual, and so they kind of wave their hands around and like open their mouth and stuff, and maybe that's what's really turning on the lady frogs rather than the sounds. I really love the irony of the whole thing. Yeah. I think it's great. So the other thing, which is another quite sad thing that happened this week, was that we finally said goodbye to Cassini after it was plunged into Saturn.
Yeah.
And so we were both looking at news stories, and we actually both brought this one, didn't we? Both, because it's so iconic. There's this mission has been, I mean, Cassini's been in space for 20 years or something. And it's actually... It was originally planned to be a 5-year mission, but then it got extended and extended and extended and extended, and so it's come to the end of its like 13-year mission now, and it plunged down to be burnt up in the atmosphere of Saturn, and apparently it had less than 1% of its fuel remaining.
Wow!
And one of the reasons that they think it lasted so long is they built in so many redundancies, and you know, they had secondary probes and all these other kind of things to kind of keep the thing going. But Cassini has made a massive number of discoveries. It first sent its Huygens probe that landed on Titan, which is the furthest landing of a probe on any other world. And it landed down on the surface of Titan and took some pictures for some minutes before it failed. And Cassini's also managed to do things like it discovered these icy plumes on Enceladus, which is another moon of Saturn. It flew through those a few times and picked up what they're composed of. It did things like looking at the structure of the rings. It saw that they actually have a width, and they have this structure that people didn't really think they had before. It also discovered these liquid lakes and oceans on Titan. Cassini's always been there, and as long as I've been a scientist, you've been hearing about the stuff from the Cassini mission. So it's really sad that it's come to an end, but we've learned quite a lot about that the only other one that I remember is the jet stream on the top of Saturn forms this really cool like hexagonal pattern, which no one had seen before.
I love this story. I think, you know, as a someone who works on the molecular level, I really like seeing space stories and the very, very big. And I think, you know, seeing, watching on Twitter, the kind of emotional response to Cassini coming to an end, or I saw someone say it quite nicely that Cassini's come home. It's come home to Saturn. And it's,
yeah.
I thought that was quite a nice way of phrasing it. And anyone who says that scientists are these rational and emotional machines should just look at the response to Cassini kind of coming, finishing its time, because I thought it was just a beautiful thing to watch.
Yeah, because you talk to people who are in these missions, they really personify this craft. You know, it's been part of their life for so long.
13 years of someone's life, right? Working with...
Exactly, yeah. And some people have been working up their entire career, or, yeah, you know, some people weren't even born when it was thought up, you know, when the design phases started, and they weren't even born, and they then work their whole life on this Cassini mission. So now, you know, goodbye Cassini. Goodbye, thank you very much.
Cassini.
Bye. So we're going to move on. We're going to go to your fifth song, which you've chosen Belle and Sebastian, like Dylan in the movies.
Yeah, I love Belle and Sebastian. There is no deep and meaningful reason for this song. They're just my favourite band. I've seen them a ton of times and they suit every single mood. I absolutely love them.
That's a good enough reason, I think. Here's Belle and Sebastian with Like Dylan in the Movies.
This is kissing man, like a long walk home when the music stops. Take a tip from me, took it to the park. When you're on your own, it's a long walk home. Well, if they follow you, don't look back. Like Dylan in the movies.
That was Belle and Sebastian with Like Dylan in the Movies. And Selena, we're talking about Alzheimer's, and you've walked us through all the research that you're doing, mm-hmm, and how actually maybe this, you know, we're finding out different ways that this disease is manifest and how it affects people. But you're also involved in some kind of more general, mm-hmm, outreaching activities which are promoting Alzheimer's. Can you talk a bit about that? Because it's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I've been involved in for quite a while, because one of the challenges with Alzheimer's and dementia, as we've already discussed, is breaking down some of the misconceptions that are surrounding the disease, such as it's only memory, it's only affecting old people. Those things are not true, and it's really important that as a society we realise that, because there are 850,000 people in the UK who are living with dementia right now, and I think we can really become a lot more dementia friendly as a society. You know, so things, a few examples, not that I've been involved in, but things like having dementia friendly checkouts in Tesco's, you know, so
yeah,
things where someone might take a little bit longer to count out their money or to pack their shopping, and they might not be doing that just to annoy you when you're rushing home for your tea. They might actually have a reason why that is the case. So I think the more our awareness increases, the better it is for society and dementia awareness as a whole. But I've also become more involved in trying to be a bit more creative and a bit more innovative with how we reach out and how we do our science communication. So for a long time, the communication that I did would be stand up, you know, scientist stands up and gives talk in front of an audience.
Yeah.
But I'm part of this bigger group now called Created Out of Mind, which is a Wellcome Trust funded project. It's really bringing together scientists and artists and musicians and people who are living with dementia to try and be a bit creative in what we can do.
Right.
Which is really fun. It's, you know, it's teaching me to be more open-minded as well about how we communicate science. I'm working with a visual artist called Charlie Murphy, who's making artwork in response to some of the research we do. And we did a little project together called the Neuronal Disco.
This is what I was reading about. This is amazing. It's like a little disco for kids and things.
For kids and adults.
And
we
adults,
actually
okay.
did. So we took this to a fest called Festival of the Brain in Folkestone, and it was essentially an indoor rave. So we do a lot of work with fluorescent tags in our cells. So we had people with finger lights dancing in the shapes of our cells, and kind of split each song up with me talking a little bit about what the cells were doing for research. It was a riot. It was great fun, a little bit crazy, but amazing fun. And I've also been doing some work with a musician friend called Hannah Peel recently, so we actually went, we grew up in the same town. We both grew up in Barnsley and we went to rival schools, but we never knew each other until some mutual friends saw us both talking about dementia on Facebook. So she was making an album of cool electronic music in response to her grandmother's dementia and her experience of seeing her grandmother go through that. So she'd been posting about that. I'd been posting about some research findings, and a mutual friend said, "You guys really need to meet." So that was, you know, the world is small. And so we met up a few times. She's been to visit the lab. I've kind of been to see her live shows and helped with some of the artwork for her album. And, you know, it's really cool that if you're just a little bit open-minded, you can really bring dementia into popular culture in quite innovative ways.
Yeah. And I mean, you were saying off air that an increase in the promotion and the awareness then kind of feeds into an increase in funding. People are more willing to help out. This then, you know, helps with the whole disease.
Absolutely. I mean, dementia research has been criminally underfunded for a long time, and it still lags behind other disease areas. And part of the reason for that is people just didn't really understand the impact that it could have on lives. Yeah. And, you know, again, going back to this thing that it's not just people getting old and forgetful, it has a serious impact on people and their families. So as that awareness shifts, it's really a good thing for research as well, because we see our funding increase and that will get us the treatments quicker.
Brilliant. So, Selena, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you want to have a Twitter or kind of anything you want to promote apart from the stuff that you've just talked about?
Yep. You can follow me on Twitter at Selena Ray, SelinaWray. And if you want any more information about dementia and dementia research just generally, I recommend checking out Alzheimer's Research UK. They have some really good fact sheets and really good evidence-based information on dementia.
Brilliant. Yeah. So you've been listening to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. If you want to listen to any of the other shows, and you can go on to listen on SoundCloud, or you can find them on iTunes in podcast format or any other way that you can get hold of podcasts. We're going to finish with your last song, which you've chosen, LCD Sound System, and you're saying that's because you're going to see them, is that right?
Yes, so I'm going from here. I've got to do a few hours in the lab and take care of those cells, but then tonight, exactly, they need their dinner, and then tonight me and a couple of friends are off to have a dance at LCD Sound System.
Nice, so thank you, and here is LCD Sound System. Thank you. And goodbye.